You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
This week on The Dan Nichols Show, I have to be on my toes because my guest is not just one of South Africa's foremost comedians, he's also somebody who not that long ago won the Comedy Roast Battle, which means behind his charming, slightly school librarian look, he could tear me to pieces at a glance should he so wish. I'm hoping he doesn't because he's happily agreed to be on the show and I am very happy to have him. Rich Le Benoit, welcome.
Thank you very much. We actually won the Roast Battle a while ago, but it's just... I think because they haven't done any more.
Well, they couldn't really. I think you set a benchmark. And probably, because when people see you, you do have, I mean, first of all, you have sort of the name of a Belgian detective, and then you have this glass look, and you really could be teaching science. And then out comes what inside, I mean, that roast battle, you could be a quite a nasty person when you want to, Mr. Benoit.
I know. It's kind of how I grew up. So we grew up around, like, especially with roast and that type of stuff. I absolutely love it. I mean, part of my armor growing up was the fact that I look like you can roast me. So I guess I just continued living that way. It's like, I look like I can roast him because a lot of people where I grew up, they look dangerous and they look funny and they look hardcore, but I was just like the soft guy who speaks English really well.
You're kind of picking on Peter Parker in the school canteen before realizing he's actually Spider-Man.
Exactly. So, yeah.
It is also that way. I say slightly in jest that there's that nasty man inside. I think what it is for a lot of people for whom comedy forms such a natural part of their lives is that it's almost a challenge yourself in that you're not really trying to hurt or upset somebody, with one or two exceptions, but it's because how clever can we be, how funny can we be, how can we make people laugh? It's not about, hey, you really are what I'm saying you are.
Oh yeah,
it's how funny am I at picking this up.
Yeah, that's true, because like you're saying, because you, I guess as an outsider, you maybe, like you're saying, you'd measure something on like, oh no, why would you say that about his granny or his mother or his obvious stutter, or you know what I mean? But it's like, it's really mean, like, oh, I'm not thinking about that. It's just like, how far can we push the envelope right now, today? And that's what I learned. Like, I learned that along the way because I mean, the baptism of fire, because you walk into a crowd and they look at you and immediately pick on your insecurities and you're like, oh, and you go home and you can't sleep for 3 days. But you get there the next day, they're just carrying on with somebody else and you're like, oh, okay. They just keep going. Oh, okay. So then you just learn to listen, digest and reply. Do you know what I mean? So that's kind of what I learned very early on.
Like, it is the story of so many comedians, that the ability to 20 years after they were being picked on at school and having their lunch stolen and their pocket money nicked by the school rugby team, they're able to stand on stage and wave at that same school rugby player who's now manning security at the door and be the really cool person because you've learned without realizing it at the time that this is how I can't fight my way out of the situation physically, but I might be able to do it verbally.
Yeah, you can talk your way out. Like, that's the thing. You've got to be able to speak your way out because you can, I mean, get into actual trouble as well, because some people don't have words. They want to be physical about it. Then you got to now learn how to diffuse that, because now this is all fine and you're all laughing and everybody steps back and like, uh-oh. He doesn't like you talking about his dead dog. Now he's like...
Yeah, I can't think why not.
He's sentimental. He's sentimental about the dog. And now he's like... Now you have to say, no, I was only joking, you know, let's do something different. You got to switch it up. So you have to learn that. So I guess that also helps you along the way, because you get, when you grow up, I'm talking about when I was less than 10 years old, these are the situations that I was in. But when you grow older and now you're performing, didn't expect that to happen, but then you get hecklers and you get people that, like, literally come up to you after, this has happened to me many times, where somebody sees you on stage, and they got this idea of you, but then they'll see you standing either by the bar or among the gentle people around where they think you shouldn't be. Then they'll use it as an opportunity to tell you how you shit, or you're just standing by us now. Remember just now you were up there, you thought you were all that. So I'm like, no, I really didn't. So I was just doing what I do. So like, you have to like always be balancing these people in your life, which is, I guess, strange on the left-hand side of comedy, I guess.
It also gives you an interesting point of departure for what's probably now the most important role in your life, which is Richly the Dad. Mm-hmm. And a little earlier this week, I did an event with John Smith where we didn't actually talk just about rugby. It certainly formed part of the conversation. But there was a lot of talk about how our lives have changed through fatherhood and through being a parent, and how it gives you this massively different perspective on life. I think in the comedy world, it certainly gives you lots of material should you wish to draw upon it.
Yeah,
but it does suddenly change so much of who you are and how you approach things that you do.
Yeah, but I guess it does. I mean, when I remember doing your show the first time, I think my boy was just born. I remember you brought it up, and I think he was like two.
I think he was being delivered, but you were on my show instead because you had your sense of priority correct, which I've always appreciated. Yeah.
But now I think, yeah, so now he's grown. He's like 9 years old, and now I've got a little girl as well. She's 7 years old. But like you're saying, so there's obviously that internal conversation that we're having at home, and then I'm also cognizant of the fact that what I say. Before I didn't care what I said. So now you also, what this, like you're saying, it's a dad thing that exists inside your mind, which you have to like quell to like, no, I am going to talk about this because I need to talk about this. But it also cuts off a lot of things that I previously would have not cared and spoke about, like whatever the subject matter might be. So like I've always been cognizant of what I want to speak of. I don't talk about certain things. Like I don't do like rape jokes or things that I wouldn't find entertaining myself. So with that, now when you have kids, there's also a lot more little things that you learn. So I always notice, like you're saying, when a comedian is a new parent, you hear that because they immediately start talking about diapers and milk and how much is powder and how much and how they don't sleep. So you'll always go through that. But then once that part's finished, now you just have a small human being at home who's learning your habits. So like I've got comedians who are funnier than me in the, every single time I say something, I'm like, and now we're getting into these like fights because they can speak very clearly on what they're very opinionated on what they think is funny, even though I'm just telling them to put their shoes away. Now it's a debate over why that was funny that you responded like, yeah, how can I put my shoes away? Yeah. I'm like, no, man. You know, we don't do this the whole time. We switch off and then we switch on. We need to be just normal. So, yeah, there's a lot of adjustment when it comes to being a parent and being a performer, I guess, at the same time, because you learn.
Your daughter is 7. Mine is 12. So what you have on the horizon is one of the coolest things you will go through in life, which is the ability to seriously embarrass your kids. And it is so much fun. I had about 48 hours of stony silence after standing up and singing to my daughter at the side of a netball match. it gave me so much pleasure. But they're also, they are these little people, and you know, they'll come out, my son in particular, he'll come out with a comment, and the parent in me should be, that's inappropriate, you shouldn't say that, please apologize to the Reverend, and the comedian side of you is going, that is brilliant. I wish I'd thought of that. I'm so proud.
So you are caught in that. I find myself caught in that all the time because, like, I have to say that. I'm like, you can't say that to that lady. If you don't know her. But at the same time, I'm also like, my son and boy go like, but you're smiling. I'm like, I'm not smiling. I'm upset.
I'm very angry.
So like you're saying, also to get the opportunity to embarrass them, because I'm like, I say to them, look, I've got a notebook. Every time you embarrass me, I write it down so that I know how many credits. So like when you turn 14, 13, 15, when you come over with your friends, when you have all these plans, then I start executing. So I'm like, I have a book. I'm on like 59 now. Because they really get out there. Like they can embarrass you. Like, oh, at a restaurant, at anywhere, as soon as the waiter comes, they'll point to the most expensive thing. Like, can we have the juice with the pulp and the ice cream and it's got the thing on top? I'm like, but no. Oh, man, you never say, yeah. I'm like, then the waiter goes away. Then like, okay, cool. We'll just have.
Yeah, I think I hit that stage when my daughter, I suggested that we go out for a daddy and daughter dinner, thinking, well, I'll try and make my way through an evening at the Spur. And she came back because she Googled things, because that's what kids do these days. And she quite liked the look of the Wagyu at Marble, where you basically need the GDP of Belgium to get in the door. David Higgs, I might need a payment plan. But it is such a cool part of watching these little people grow and develop become something. And I think back again to my son when he was probably 3. 3-4 years old. I'd asked both of my children what they wanted to be when they were older. After much consideration, my daughter said that she wanted to be a swimming lesson teacher. So financially disastrous, but educational. So very proud of you, my darling. Asked my son what he wanted to be. Zero hesitation. When he grew up, he wanted to be a horse. So, Vodacom Durban July, here we come. But I wonder when you look at what you do and the immense amount of pleasure you both get out of what you do and that you get other people who get to watch what you do. And I think back to my conversation with John Smith earlier this week where he was talking about how at school one of the kids at Saheti School where we're doing the evening asked about when should we start specialising in sport. And at the moment, you know, you can be 3 years old in Pretoria and you've got a rugby contract at the Bulls and they're feeding you protein and getting you ready to play for the Boks. He was of a very different view that, no, you must try everything and do as much as you can. And I wonder, does Richelieu Benoît have this view of the little ones being comedians, being entertainers one day? Is that something you'd like, something you'd nudge them towards?
No, not really, hey? I believe that everybody has their thing. Like, personally, I love comedy, I love speaking, I love entertaining people. And I feel it's inside of me. Like, nobody trained me, nobody directed me. It was the spontaneous thing that just happened one day and it was all natural. But I've learned the system. I've been in the system for the longest time. I think it's like 20 years this year. But it's also like I wouldn't force anybody into anything, into entertainment especially, because you start relying on people like early on. I mean, you eventually start to not rely on people, but you still rely on people. Like, you need people to come out. You need people to support you. You need people to put you on initially. Like, you always need people. Whereas if there's other things where you don't need people, maybe that's your thing. There's a tennis player, there's a cricket player, and there's a football player. You know what I mean? So, like, a tennis player stands alone, and a cricket player stands alone, but he's also got his backup, and then the footballer's got 10 other guys running around with him. So, like, everybody has their structure. And everybody either relies on somebody or doesn't rely on somebody. And everybody loves something or you don't love something. So that's where I stand. It's like, I will never nudge you. I've always wanted people, I like people to be funny. Like, everybody that I'm surrounded with in life is funny to some degree, because there's no use me or you or anybody just, like, who wants to hang around with sourpuss? Is sourpuss a real word?
It certainly is. And I think if you're looking for those people you claim don't exist, people who aren't actually funny, I'll take you to a lovely spot called Home Affairs when you've got some free time. There are a couple there who might match.
I actually went to pick up my license yesterday, so I've been in contact with those.
I think we have quite a similar view in that, you know, let's see where your kids go, see where they develop. But I think we're also from a not dissimilar generation whereby, yeah, kind of your parents did want you to become the lawyer, the doctor, the engineer, get the degree, go to university. In fairness, my parents were not too strict in that sense. But when you tell your parents you're going to be a comedian, by and large, they're not dancing in the streets, phoning all their friends and loading up the family WhatsApp group with great cheers and pride. What was the family reaction when you decided that, I actually want to try this comedy thing?
Yeah, so for me, it was like the timing was strange, because my parents had just moved to Australia. So they'd been in Australia this entire time. So the timing when they left, I was staying in our house alone. And I was into comedy already, because my dad was really big in comedy. So, like, even now I've still got all of the original Eddie Murphy vinyls and, like, the old, like, everything. So it's got, like, the Red Fox, and it's got they're all there. Like, literally all of the old acts are there. I've got the Richard Pryor.
That's comedy gold.
The Bill Cosby.
I'm coming around to your house all evening. I'll bring the wine.
So like, growing up, I'd listen to these things. So he wouldn't be there, right? So when he left, he'd be like, don't listen to my Eddie Murphy specifically. And when he's gone, my brother and I would sit and we'd listen.
First thing you do is listen to Eddie Murphy.
We tell jokes around now. So we had, outside of the house, we were funny because we had all the punchlines. He knew all the bits. And then didn't think about it for a while. Didn't think about it at all, in fact. So I was busy working in IT, carrying on there. And then when they moved overseas, I was alone. And so a guy, this friend of mine, gave me a spindle filled with DVDs filled all with comedy. Like all comedy, all comedy. Like when I say all comedy, I mean literally from like the David Gow, the Pure Monati show, the Russell Peters, and then the Chris Rock, and like literally a spindle of everything you could find. Cool. So I'm sitting at home and I'm watching these, and then while I'm watching these things, like, because nobody's there, I go to work, I come back, I lay down, I put this thing, got a TV in my room, I'm watching this, and the whole, and then I just started thinking to myself, you know what, I can also write these bits. So I just started writing bits with no plan, again, no plan. I didn't mean like, I'm going to write these bits and perform them. I just had this paper and I just wrote every day in a little book.
I'm picturing you cornering people in the office at the water cooler and trying out a bit of comedy.
Yeah, so, well, yeah, so I had a friend of mine who was like my I guess my bouncing board. Every day I would just say, I wouldn't let him know that. I would just say, hey, what's up with Jesus? And he'd be like, oh, that's hilarious. I'd be like, yeah, man, yeah. And the next day, then you just do that. Like, I would just keep doing that. And then I met Corvin Goldstone, right? So the guy that gave me the spindle, it's crazy how things work. So the guy that gave me the spindle was friends with Corvin Goldstone, who was just getting into comedy or had just gotten into comedy, which didn't really exist in Durban for the greater part. I mean, I knew Mark Banks and I knew John Flismas. I mean, I was already kind of in touch with what was going on, but there's no rooms, no scene, no like real things were happening. And then I guess I went out with Corvin. I went to meet Corvin, who told me he's doing a show. So I went to first watch the show. And then I watched this guy performing because he grew up in the same area as me. So it's previously disadvantaged. It's colored neighborhood. It's got all the negative connotations. There's gangsterism and all of these things. Then I saw him performing and he was talking about where we live, but in a funny way. Then I was like, nah, I'm hooked. I was like, immediately. I went to his house. I showed him my bits. And then he also was gassing me on. Like, yeah, this needs to go on. This needs to happen. So like, literally a month after me meeting Corvin, we did a show called Laughing Stock, which was at a pub in Westville somewhere. And then from then, we just, yeah, it was just like every month we did that show, and then that just kept going. And then that was like 2007. Then 2010, I moved to Johannesburg. And then for me, after that, it was just head down and just learning everything every day, meeting all these guys. And I came here, it was an eye-opener because in Durban, it was just us running shows. There were shows at the theater. There was people coming and going here and there. But when I came to Johannesburg and I've met like John Flismas here at the Underground, and then there was Wish on the corner, and then I met Kagiso Ladikga and Loiso Kola and Eugene Kors and David Gow. Then I was like, this is madness. This is out of control. I met Chris Forrest, which is still, he's still one of my closest allies when it comes to comedy, because I early on used to lean on him for, because I loved his style, like that deadpan, very clever. So I started to lean on him for ideas, like how to deliver things and how does it work? Does this work? Does this work? So I guess I stuck to him. So he's still up to now like one of the guys that I still regularly see and regularly sit with, because of the way that he addresses and approaches things. I mean, he's even got a comedy school now. I think I was the first student.
Without realizing. So you go from Durban, where basically if you and Carvin are in a room together, that means both of Durban's comedians are out on the same night. And then you suddenly come up to Johannesburg. It is a much bigger comedy world, but a much more exciting one and lots of great opportunity. And the IT world starts to slip away.
Yeah.
And so you embrace this new comedy space. Was there a particular gig, a particular event, particular moment where just everything clicked, the audience rocked, and you walked off stage going, yep, I think this is where I need to be?
Yeah, so for me it was, literally the first night I ever did comedy was like the adrenaline, and I didn't sleep that night, right? Because I couldn't. There's like this, like even now if I have like comedy, if it's great, I can't sleep. I get home and I just sit on the couch and I just watch TV aimlessly, and then I'll take a shower and I lay in bed and I can't sleep because my mind, I keep replaying the thing, and I have this feeling inside of me that I guess that's the feeling that you initially get. So when I first did, the first night I ever did it, it was cool, and I was like, okay, I couldn't sleep. And then we had lots of good nights, but then when I came to Johannesburg and I met John Flismas again, because I'd known John Flismas from the time I was like 15 or 16, he used to work at my auntie at the Players. My aunt was like a stylist, so that's how I knew him. So like I just knew him as a person who performed, and then I started seeing his act. I was way too young to watch his act, but I'd see it at the Playhouse. I'd go and watch him. And then when I reconnected with him, he was running the Underground. And then everybody was like, you got to play the underground. That's the place. You got to play. And I'm like, okay. I come in through a little bit of easy in for me because I already kind of had this history with John. I was like, yo, can I play? Yeah. He's like, okay, cool. Let's see. Yeah, okay, no stress. And then I got up and I played the first day. And it was lovely. It was nice. Everybody was laughing. I mean, it was a 20 rand gig. I think it was 15 rand at the door or something like that. We got paid like 40 rand.
You've hit the big time.
And then that was like the first night. And then it was fun, but it wasn't great. So then I met Robbie Collins and he met a couple of other. He introduced me to like David Kibuka and Eugene and those type of guys. So then Kibuka was booking a place called the Blues Room, which is in Sandton. So I went down to play again the Sunday. Kibukas are cool. I'll come check you out. But then that day, because I know these guys came to watch me, and these guys, I don't know them, but I know that I need to impress them like that. So I did my set. It's great as usual. It's nice, fun times. And when I came off, nobody said anything except like Kibuka gave me like two things. He's like, don't say black people in that tone. Don't say this in that tone. And then come play Blues Room on Tuesday. Then I was like, After that, so I was like, I'm going to Blues Room.
I'm part of the game.
Yeah, I was in. Then I went to Blues Room. Blues Room was lovely. People are paying 200 rand a ticket. They're eating steaks. Trevor Noah's there. Luis Agola's there. And I'm like, wow, this is for me. I'm like, the other day, we were playing in a bar.
In Westville.
So for me, that was kind of like what felt like, okay, cool, this is where I need to be. The industry is accepting kind of me. I feel like I'm different in because I'm unique to where I'm from and who I, and what I think of and what I speak of. So that was for me. That was kind of weird. I'm like, I can't. I'm throwing my CV away now.
But fast forward to today, the David Kibuka you met, who often describes himself as the Barack Obama of Krugersdorp. He was the first black head boy of Krugersdorp High, the imported Ugandan, left before March to March could encourage him to do so. Went over to New York and wrote for Trevor and did so many great things. And all those names you've mentioned have gone on to do incredible things. But in that time since you kicked off comedy 20 years ago, and it seems, I'm sure, both like yesterday and an eternity ago, we've seen the comedy industry go through a lot, and those awful lockdown and COVID days were very much the dark time for so many in the entertainment industry. But you get back to today, that you were down last week or two down in Durban reuniting with your mate Carvin and having a great deal of fun. Two decades on, does that passion for comedy still burn so brightly? Do you still get that same kick, that same buzz when you walk off stage and the crowds of thousands, which you normally attract, are screaming your name and waving placards and demanding you come back for more?
The COVID part, I feel like I've kind of blacked it out, like, you know, it's like that.
Did it really happen? Let's pretend it
did. Yeah, because I can't not think about it. That's the thing. Like, you can't, like, I always mention it, like, every now and again. I'm like, do you know that we were there? It was a pandemic. Like, I mean, I fly, I wear the mask, I still, in my car, I still have the sanitizer. I'm stained for life, right? COVID hurt me like that.
If you're listening to this, not watching it, Richelieu's actually in a full hazmat suit at the moment, joining me on the show.
Even because I didn't wear glasses, and they said you don't get sick if you wear glasses. I started wearing glasses to cover the eyes. The COVID part of it was very difficult. I started a little podcasty thing, and I was just going through the motions. And I think fortunately for me, I'd done something literally just before that, which allowed me to survive a bit. And I started a sneaker cleaning company. So I started taking in sneakers and refurbishing and sending out sneakers. So just keeping myself busy, keeping a little bit of money coming in and out, but nothing that was, I guess, that could be sung from the top of the hills, right? So it was just movement. But then fast forward to now. So, for example, we did the show last week at Carvin, last week or the week before. It's a very different feeling because, I've been on the scene for a while, but I only think that now I've gotten to the point where people know who you are with regards to what to expect you to say and what they expect you to do. So they know your face, they know your profile, they've seen you on, or they've seen you like doing Dan Nickel, or they've seen you doing something here on stage there. But I feel, I guess it's social media's kind of also been a part of that, where it's become more of a thing for people. So more people of all ages are on their phones or checking out social media or checking your profile or checking your account, that type of thing. So I feel like that's kind of pushed me in a direction where people more understand me as a comedian. So it also makes it easier, but also it makes it more entertaining for me as well to perform. So like, I find that it's easier if I don't have to do the groundwork, if I don't have to do a long setup and bring you into my world. Whereas if some when I'm doing a show like I did the other week, it's like when I step on stage, we're already on the same page.
Yeah.
And I like that. And so, yeah, so with that, I guess the passion doesn't go away. I mean, I'm walking off the air, I still have the same buzz. It's still the same thing. I don't think it's ever not going to be that for me. It's just like when I start getting too tired, like when I need to be at home sleeping, that'll be the end. I'll just start performing from my couch and just stream.
I'm not surprised the passion is still there, but it's lovely to hear nonetheless. You did reference one of your other passions. You didn't just randomly start a sneaker cleaning business. This is something you are close to medically obsessed with in terms of sneakers. And as you said that, I saw what you did. You not only looked, but you judged. You judged my shoes. And in fact, I got here slightly late, not as late as our intern who's putting things together, but I got here slightly late because I actually stopped and went home to change my shoes because I knew that you were my guest and I know how much shoes mean to you. So I don't know if you've seen these before. If you're watching, you might be able to pick them up. These are Stan Smith, but these are the limited edition Circolisi specials.
Oh, I can see the tongue. Yeah.
So on the tongue, there is a really cool kind of pop art image of Circolisi. And no, before you ask, you can't have them, Richelieu, because I rather like them. But I did choose the pair that I thought I could impress you with most.
And what's the 914? Is that, was it 9? 14, what is that? Is that a World Cup?
914.
It looks like a date, September.
No, there are only 14 pairs ever made, and I've got number 9.
Oh, this is number 9. Wow, okay.
I'm not entirely sure. It might actually be the case. Let's pretend that it is.
Yeah, it's either September 2014 or 9 or 14.
I actually put down the date, 14 September. I need to get them cleaned again. So that was just to remind me when I saw
you. And I did look down at your shoes. I can't help that. And it's weird, though. I do judge people.
You have this shoe fetish.
I don't, yeah, but I also feel like when your shoes also tell a story of how you are like a person. I feel it. I don't know if it's true, but it's how I feel. It's like if I came like to meet you and we're going out somewhere and you've got these dirty shoes, and I'm like,
doesn't reflect well on you.
Yeah, you're gonna get in a fight later, or you don't do things like I do. You don't look after yourself because you can't take a minute to wipe your shoe before you leave home. It's just a thing. It's how I am.
So I've got a collection. I've been very lucky to have a relationship with Adidas for many, many years, and I've got some really cool shoes over those years. When new ones arrive, there's a very simple process. It is make sure my wife does not see. It is bribe my housekeeper not to tell my wife that these shoes have arrived, and then very casually slip them into the not one, but two 6 foot tall footwear air racks that I have at home. And then my wife will spot them. Are those new? No. Those were ages. Richelieu just cleaned them for me. That's why they look so new.
Is that ones that you are purchasing or ones that you were just acquiring through the system?
So I would have more than enough shoes if it was just ones that the Adidas team were very kind enough to send my way. But I might occasionally add to them with a little bit of online shopping, because sometimes there is just a pair in there. You know this. You just have to have them. It's our inner Imelda Marcos. Yes, we've got 806 pairs, but number 807 is the one that will complete us until, of course, we see number 808 a week later.
That's absolutely for me, there's shoes in my wardrobe that I've had for, I guess, the greater part of, I guess, 15 years, 16. They haven't even been worn. So we have to now go through a process of taking them out, making sure I got to make sure that they're not getting damaged from the environment. So you got to put the silica bags in. So now this year, I was like, and I've been saying this for many years, I'm like, I'm going to start wearing my shoes. So this year, I'm like, okay, I just start opening boxes and putting them on. And like, I just started wearing them. So it's like, it feels like I'm breaking out of this. I've been holding myself back because I'm like, what happens is eventually they do become crumbly, or they do start getting discolored without you even having worn them. So I'm like, ah, I'd need rather wear them. So I'm going through a renaissance now.
my brother-in-law, he'd make a great serial killer. He not only keeps his shoes extremely clean, but he reboxes them after wearing them. Yeah. Are you the same kind of?
Absolutely. I had to find these this morning. I had to dig in all the boxes. Like,
in the vault.
But I've been wearing these quite a bit. These are just the Air Max ones, so, which is one of my favorite shoes. I'm also a very big Adidas guy. I've got lots of Adidas. Of course, for years I wore Adidas, but then they didn't give me a sponsor. So I was like, I'll start wearing other things. So I started off with Nike as a youngster. And like now I've gotten back into the Nikes. I didn't want to follow Nikes because everybody started trying to make it trendy. And I'm not trying to be trendy. I just really like them. That's why I like the old school silhouettes. But now the problem is, like you said, the kids are there. So now my boy sees me.
Oh.
So
they want the shoes that you wear, but also I'm just waiting for probably about 5-6 years' time when my son's feet are the same size as mine.
Yeah.
And suddenly, darling, have you seen my new Stan Smiths that I'm planning to wear on stage for the 8 hours I have to be standing up hosting a gala dinner? Ah, yes, Aiden's taken them. He's gone off with his mates for the night.
Yeah, but I mean, we all did that, I guess. I went through my dad's shoes as well. My boy can't wait. He's also like, oh. Every time we're buying, he's like, buy those. I said, he's like, I think those are nice. You know, every time you're like, in about 5 years or 6 years, I'm going to have them. And I'm like, no, that's not the reason we buy shoes. And it also tries to clean. So I keep the sneaker wipes handy at all times. So
I've
every
got
time
those
I,
as well.
In my toiletry bag, there's sneaker wipes. In the car, there's sneaker wipes. And then you'd be like, I need to clean my shoes. I'm like, no,
you are next level.
No, your shoes are okay.
It is one area of great passion / obsession. There's also quite an interest in cars. And if I remember, I'm not sure if you still have it, but I think there was one. It might have been an old school BMW that you had at one point, or there was some old car that I think you had.
I used to drive the E30, the box shape.
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, the saddest thing, I sold that car because I bought another car, and it was just sitting for so long. And I sold it for ridiculous amounts at the time. I sold it for like 3 times what everybody was asking because it was fully original. But since then, I love those cars. I just didn't want it to become like rotten inside my garage. Every time I drove it, the brakes, I'd put new brakes. I'd take it for a drive, the headlights, I'd put a new headlight. So I'm like, every time I drive it, I'm fixing something. So I thought I'd rather give it to somebody who's going to use it constantly. But I think the guy I sold it to also doesn't use it. I think he just, now it's just an investment thing that he's got in there. He's got a massive investment that he made a small investment, but now he's got an item there that's worth way more. But yeah, I still look at them all the time. I love a box-shaped BM. Not for the reasons that people would think, because like most people love the kusheshe, it's a spin car, there's someone hanging out the sunroof, and it does. I'd like it. I've always liked it. That car came out when I was about 8-9 years old, and when I was young, my father used to drive Ford XR3, which is also a car I fell in love with and bought my own. But every time we'd drive down the road, I'd see these box-shaped BMs driving by, but our car went like, and I was in... Woo! And I'm like, I said to my father, why are their cars sounds like that? Yeah, these BMs, they're rubbish. And I'm like, no, man. Look. So every time one came by, I would look and listen and, what is that car? Why is it like that? Then I found out that if it had a 2 and a 5 in the back, it sounded better than if it had the 1 and the 6 in the back. And then I started, I'm like, what is a 2 and a 5? So I started learning about those cars very early on. But yeah, so I still have a BM. I can't move away from BMs. I love BMWs, but I just don't have an E30 anymore. I need to get one in my life. Somebody listening is going to phone me in.
It leads me then to a question as we look forward. You've done so much already, and it's been a wonderful career, but it is far from finished. If I could give you the 3 wishes, your lamp has been rubbed and you've come up with them, and you are heading off in the pair of trainers of your dreams, in the car of your dreams, to share the comedy stage with one particular comedy icon from across the years, the comedy you've been listening to, growing up with, perhaps performed alongside, what would that trifecta of shoes, car, comedian be?
Because I'm, like I'm saying, I'm so simple in the things that I like and the things that make me happy and that what makes me comfortable. If I had to choose a shoe that I would go as the dream shoe, it would probably be the Air Max 1, or the Dunk Pigeons, but probably the Air Max 1, because that was the first shoe that when they came out, or when I first saw them, and I had to go and convince my parents, like, I need a shoe. Because we used to wear canvas shoes, remember that? So canvas shoes was just the thing, and then the sports shoes were not really big in the country, like, if you weren't into sports, I guess. So when we started learning about Nike and Adidas and the swoosh and the air bubbles and all of these things, then at school, boys would be drawing him on the wall and sketching him all over. And that's how I started to learn about them. And then I had to convince my dad and my mom that I need a shoe that at the time cost 600 rand or something like that.
Which is about 4 million rand today.
Exactly. And that was like in the early mid-90s. And then they gave me like a list of things I need to do, which obviously I had to do well at school and make sure the car is washed and make sure your bed's made. And then I just went into this mode of like, no one, if you drop a paper, it's like Mauritius, nobody's around. I was just living that life. And then eventually I got a pair, but then the pair, and then I got another pair. And then so it just grew on me. So like for me, it would probably be the Air Max 1 I would be wearing on my feet. The car would definitely be an E30 box shape, the four-door. Not even, like, the IS is nice. I like all of them. But for me, I really like the sedan, the four-door sunroof. I had two like that. So that's, for me, I've always liked those ones. It's just because it's not trying to be flashy. It's just being an E30. That's all it's being. It's not trying to get. And remember, every time you go around the block, people are clapping. And like, that car, people is like literally clap because the first one I bought was around 2007 or so. I had a blue E30 in Durbs, which was also like hotted up. It had the pipes and all these funny things. So every time I was driving that car, if you drive past guys, they'd whistle. If you stop it, put petrol in there, they'd dance around the car. And my wife used to be like, that's sometimes my girlfriend. She'd be like, I think you need to sell this car.
I remember Chris Forrest saying that pretty much every time he was with you in that car, somebody offered to buy it.
Somebody offered to buy it every time. I couldn't take my eyes off the car. That was the thing. So like, if I'm sitting here and I've got the car and I know it's not in a locked up thing, every 10 or 15 minutes I'm going to get up and go and look at the car. Or if I didn't see the car, then someone would put a letter in the car. Like, please just call me. And I'm like, bro, it's my car. Let me drive it. But with regards to performing, if I had to have the honor of bringing on somebody that I, there's so many. I mean, I grew up on listening to like Red Fox and Bill Cosby and Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor. There's so many acts. Like, and I, as soon as I got mature, I started listening more to like Jerry Seinfeld because I started learning about the wit part of it. But if I had to make a choice, and I'd be forced to make a choice, I'd probably go with one of the earlier ones, which would probably be like maybe Richard Pryor is too big, but it's too cliche as well. So maybe
he did write the book on comedy in so many
ways. Yeah, it's like everybody's going to say that. But like for me, it's also Red Fox. I still love Red Fox because he had the series, what is it called? Sanford and Son. So I used to watch that with my brother and we used to roar with laughter because this old man was so hilarious. And then I didn't know that time that people that were funny on TV actually were performers up there. So when I started listening to Red Fox as well. So I guess, yeah, I think it would be Red Fox. Eh? Just as because it's just such an iconic act and just such an iconic voice for me growing up with regards to comedy and just being completely off the sensor and just being so funny. So yeah, I think Red Fox in a box shape BM wearing Air Force or Air Max ones, definitely.
I think that is a pretty cool lineup. The only downside, of course, is that life hurtles downhill thereafter, because that would be just about as good as life could get for Richelieu Benoit, with one grand exception, of course, and that's that when all that is set aside, the really important stuff is still there, and that's the that family who I think have given you such such a wonderful completion to who you are and to absolutely. What you do. And given us such a great conversation. So thank you for that. I've managed to escape, I think, without feeling too much of the roasting prowess of Monsieur Benoit.
Yeah, no, I didn't even go in on the shoes or anything.
You wanted to. But Richelieu, thank you. Please keep entertaining us.
Thank you.
Keep giving us as much pleasure as you clearly get from what you do. And I shall be round with a couple of bottles of wine to listen to some old vinyls of great classic comedy, but I promise to sit on the other side of the couch and I shall sanitize extensively with
you. No, we're okay now. I think we've kind of gotten over that hurdle. We're okay. We'll survive. It's just airplanes, restaurants. It's just like shake handshakes. Like more than five handshakes, I start thinking, I need to.
Yes, our welcome hug in the car park was very awkward. I did notice that. I shall remember for next time. Richelieu, above all, congratulations. 20 years of comedy, 20 years escaping IT, and 20 years giving us much joy. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to see you and to have conversations with you, because I find you really funny. So it's always a pleasure.
There we go. Reading the line I gave to him to close the show out. Richelieu Benoit, no, he's not an aristocrat from northern France. He is, in fact, one of Durban's greatest treasures, a young man who swapped life behind a computer screen for making people laugh on stage. And gee, he's been doing an incredible job now for 20 years. My guest this week on The Dan Nicholls Show, Richelieu Benoit.
You're listening to The Dan Nicholls Show.